Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Full Service Radio. Welcome to the Dolcezza Sherbert Experience. We are live at the Line Hotel on Full Service Radio. This is Violeta, your host. I'm co-owner of Dolcezza Gelato in Washington, D.C. We make gelato. We've been around for 15 years. Longer than that. We've been around for 15 years making gelato. And I'm here with my lovely partner.
Co-host, co-conspirator, co-owner, Rob Duncan, Dolcezza Gelato.
And we're super excited today to have Simon Jacobson with us. Thank you for coming, Simon. Simon is a Jill of all trades, guys. She is the co-owner of Tolly Molly.
The Jill and the Jack.
A Jill in this case.
I like it.
A Burmese bodega in Union Market. She teaches yoga. She organizes art and community events. And she was recently celebrated by Bon Appetit magazine as one of the women around the country who are redefining wellness. So that's pretty badass. Congrats on that, Simone, and thank you for coming.
Thank you so much. This is such a pleasure to be here with both of you.
For sure. So I want to talk about wellness for a second, since you were celebrated for redefining wellness. So what does wellness mean to you?
Oh, such a good question. I think that there's a yogic mantra that we do that in Sanskrit is loka samasta sukhino bhavantu, meaning may all beings be happy and free, and may my thoughts, my speech, and my action in some way contribute to that happiness and that freedom. And so it doesn't mean that we always get it perfect, but it means that I think we extend first kindness and compassion to ourselves and then out from there. And so for each person, I think wellness is very personal. And that's something we don't talk about a lot, right? I think that in the context of capitalism and in the context of...
Wellness comes in the form of a pill prescribed, yeah, manufactured by a pharmaceutical here.
Sure, and it's something to be bought and sold and traded and coveted, and that it actually, the idea of wellness makes people feel unwell a lot of times because they're so worried about meeting some kind of impossible standard. So to me, wellness is the pursuit of our own happiness and liberation, and also doing everything we can to what I would say, do no harm but take no shit. So, you know, we are in pursuit of a life that is good for us and good for others, and that looks different for everybody. It depends on so many different things, and I hope that most people know that it's an imperfect and messy process, and that's why a lot of the work that I do happens in non-traditional environments. So even though I do teach some classes in studios, I also teach at the jail, I teach at the library, I teach in parks, I teach my family, I teach my friends, and so starting close to you and then radiating outwards from there.
It's community now. It's all about community.
Yeah, but also about the self, right? So when people
starting with the self, because
yeah,
one can't teach if they don't get their shit taken care of on the inside, right? So
yeah,
the teacher is who's teaching. So that, yeah, it starts always with the self, but it's like in your family, then your friends, it's like that community is everything, because even when you're not well, then you need the community maybe to help you, lift you up, like, and then vice versa.
Yeah, so we all need each other.
Yeah.
And I love what you say about wellness not being something people feel like is something that they need to achieve. And going back to this idea that we already have this within, and it's kind of the opposite, right? It's trying to see, trying to go within and express your best self and see that it's already there, that there is nothing that you need to do, actually, that is exactly the opposite. It's very much, you know, being in the present moment and honoring who you are. That's what I'm hearing from you. And it resonates really deeply with what we believe.
It's a much more Eastern viewpoint, too. You know,
yeah,
the West is from, it's all on the outside, and you need it from the outside. We're the East. I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday, And it was like, in the West, if you have the realization after what working and like, oh, I'm God. In the West, they'll take you aside, they'll straitjacket you, they'll inject you with Thorazine, and they'll put you up in an institution somewhere where you'll never be heard from again. If you go and say, I'm God, in the East, the yogi, the guru, the lama, whoever, the teacher, will then go, you've achieved another level of like what this reality and realization is all about. You know, it's such a radical, fundamental, different way of seeing self and universe and reality. It's really, we come up against that Western viewpoint all the time. Obviously, we're here.
That is very centered on the ego.
Yeah, the ego. And look, and you look at, you tune in the news right now and look at where it's taken us to an extreme. I mean, if we have three kids, they're coming up right now with the notion, the idea, the thought of the earth is being destroyed. And then you hear it all over and over, climate change, glaciers melting, superstorms, the increasing of the ocean temperatures, et cetera, et cetera. And I just always like, what would it be like to be a child and to hear that that's maybe happening? Because it's still in the greater conversation, it's speculative because of government doubts, really mostly from us, from the United States of America and the corporations of, you know, and governments casting doubt on that for various reasons. But it's I don't know where the fuck we started on this thread.
I don't know, Rob.
But you know, this, yeah, welcome, Simone.
I want to go back to the yoga. So you teach this class that is called Yoga for Everybody in two words.
So it started from that East and West yoga viewpoint, and like, yeah, off ranting on the government.
And this is aimed at people of color and queer and trans and anyone who's ever felt out of place in a yoga space. So tell me more about this class, and did you come up with this idea?
Yes and no. There are a lot of people right now, I think, in the United States that are recognizing that there needs to be a decolonization of the practice, and that accessibility and inclusion doesn't just come from saying nobody's going to be turned away for non-payment, right? That's not enough. And so we have to do more. And what I noticed as someone that doesn't have the stereotypical maybe yoga body, that doesn't have the stereotypical yoga experience, a lot of us, like me, came to the practice because of injury. I was a dancer, and I started practicing because I was too frustrated in the dance studio. My brain understood the movements, but my body hadn't healed enough, and I needed something that I could be gentle with myself in doing. And given that I had never practiced before, that was the space where I could do that. But it was very painful, both physically, emotionally, energetically, spiritually, all of it. And you know, before the show, we were talking about pain as a potential tipping point for growth. It was a huge opportunity for growth for me internally and externally. And so when I became a teacher, I started to see how accessible the practice could be. Because really, I think you only need two things to be able to practice, and that's to be able to breathe and to be able to move. And movement can be as small as the blinking of the eyes and the beating of the heart, things that everybody has to do to stay alive. So there's literally no one who should or need be excluded from a practice that can help reshape our cognitive abilities, can help transform our nervous system. So to prevent heart attack, to prevent high anxiety and stress, all these things that we grapple with as human beings and not human doings. And so, yeah, so there are other people, there are lots of other people around the country who are doing this, but in Washington, D.C., I didn't find enough spaces where it felt like all people were being celebrated. So, for example, my friends with really young kids, you know, my kid's 4, can I bring them? And I'll always say to them, you know, everybody means everybody, right? Because a lot of times you'll have like a mommy and me class, or you'll have children's yoga, all of which I think are really valuable. But then where are the spaces that really mirror the origins of the tradition, which is everyone all together? You know, it's funny, one of my recent students, we were talking about diversity and accessibility, inclusion, a student training to be a yoga teacher. And she said, well, I'm from Europe, you know, it seems that you have a different understanding of identity here in the U.S. You know, I didn't have to think about these questions in Europe. And I said, well, I bet that there were people in wheelchairs where you come from. And there are people who are deaf or hard of hearing. And there are people who are other races, because she was really focused on nationality. And she said, yes, I guess there are. We don't think of that. And I thought, well, as, you know, somebody white and European, you may not think about that. And also, it is true that in the United States, we have a different history. And so all these things for us, I think, are important to have this space where I've had students, you know, 70 and above in the same room as students 4 and, you know, 4 to 12. And we don't have enough intergenerational spaces in the United States, or third spaces. And a yoga practice space where people are just breathing and moving, like, there's no reason that that can't be a space where people of different ages, abilities, and backgrounds can be in the same room. And it's not to preach. It's to open a door. And when these 4-year-olds come into this room, you know, I mean, I used to teach preschool, you have small children, their presence is a gift. And people, even if you sense a little resistance, generally in my classes, there isn't, because people know what kind of space they're coming into. But when you sense a little resistance in the beginning, you feel it immediately fall away, because you have this little kid going and reminding everyone to breathe without saying, hey, you guys, breathe. Just watching him, just being in the space with him is so healing for everyone.
Children are super magical. Oh. And we need them.
Important.
We need them.
And elders too.
And we usually just want to get away from children and elders.
Yeah.
So it's extremely important.
Again,
to,
like,
we were talking about the true self. I feel like children express it naturally. So they are still not as contaminated as we are. So they have that magic. And then the elders have the experience and the knowledge. And then we're all lost and confused. And we don't have anywhere.
It's the middle part of the process. Yeah. We get lost. It's like at the very end and the beginning, that's close to each other. It's like it's more true to the self. Because when you're a little child, you don't have the conditioning yet. When you're older and closer to death, you're kind of beyond that. Like,
right.
that shit doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah.
It's in the middle that the ego and the self and the definition and all that kind of goes crazy and gets one extremely lost and deep in the muddle of suffering, you know?
Yeah, and I think in the human experience, in human history, there's always been, you know, it takes a village. In most places in the world, they understand that. And the United States really casts children and elderly, like, especially now where there's a big focus on technology and buy more and do these things so you can buy more things, right? Work so you can buy more things. You know, don't like yourself so you can buy more things. All these messages that we get causes that divide to widen even. And I think that that's really one of the things that makes our society very sick.
We don't value family. We don't have
the two greatest teachers.
We don't value family in this in America. And you can just look at it from how much paid time off does a mother get for having a baby.
Or where do people put their parents when they're too old to be quote-unquote useful?
Exactly. Tuck them away in a home and then never see them again. You know, it's like we don't value in this country what is the most important thing about being alive here is like the family unit, you know, the self and obviously the loving self, but the family unit is like, we don't take care of that. It's like, again, the mothers and fathers have to go away and hustle 2 jobs to pay for all the stuff that they're doing, the bills, the mortgage and all that. And so kids get put to daycare at 4 weeks old, you know, and the mom doesn't get time off when she has the baby, let
and
alone
the dad
the
too.
Father. The father,
right.
I mean, even less so. And I always...
Both are needed.
Yeah, you know, it's like we kind of, we lose sight of that, of how important that is and would result in a so much more healthier, more productive society.
We are
large.
Very passionate about that. We've had a lot of talks with other people about it and how research shows that the first 2 years of your life define, like, even people who are focused on academics or performance, they should understand that the more time they're spending with their kids, the better their kids are going to be in the future. So I think there's also that aspect.
I was going to say, I know that you're supposed to interview me, but I just want to
know because I think that,
you know, earlier this week, Violetta and I had a chance to talk a little bit about this, but I think listeners would be interested to know you are a family business, not just as partners, but also the children you were mentioning earlier in the week are involved. Can you talk a little bit about how you've been able to integrate your work, life, home, family, and how you kind of radically and boldly do that?
So that's one of the main reasons why we own our business. It's not so much about making gelato, which we love, and food and coffee, but it's very much about being able to live in our own terms. That's the goal. And the goal ultimately is freedom. And so that freedom comes from creating your own reality. And that's what we're doing. And therefore, we want to like show that to our children naturally. There is nothing prescribed.
Right. It's not so much intentional or a conscious thing. It's just the MO, the way that we do things is thus, you know.
And so that involves functioning as a community. And therefore, we're all in this together. And so if I have a baby, I'm going to go to see my CPA with my baby. My baby's with me, and it's a baby, and it's the mama.
So, you know, back up just a second, because she probably won't go there, but as far as, like, to say to the degree that this is something that we value, and to the degree that this girl is a fucking badass, it all started with having a baby, bringing that baby into this world. And we did it in our bedroom, and the first one in a co-op here in Adams Morgan. I went around to all the neighbors and said, if you hear somebody screaming like crazy, just know I'm not killing anybody or I'm not killing her. We're having a baby in our apartment here in the co-op in Adams Morgan. And then we moved up to Petworth in our house and had the other two babies there at home in our bedroom with midwives. So it's like,
it's just this idea of bringing them into the world without trauma is impossible because they suffer, but with the less possible traumatic environment.
The way that it naturally happens in general, there are complications. And for that, thank goodness there is intervention in hospitals. But in general, things like
that. And talk about empowering women, right?
Right.
When you give birth, you are like at the top of the world. It's the highest of the highest. And it's painful, but it's an experience that brings so much strength to you. And after you've done it, you're like, I'm a freaking superhero. Well, I can tackle on whatever.
Yeah, for a woman, what I've seen sitting alongside of during the birth of the three girls that we've had, after that, I came away saying there is not one thing that a woman could do in her life on this planet more empowering than have a child that way. And so then you have, and you look into it, and you see how the industry, insurance, pharmaceutical, AMA, doctors, and all that, have systematically taken away that most amazing, most empowering birthright right of a woman, you know, and it's powerful.
And when
you
think about patriarchy, you think about, you know, maybe the reason why we are in the situation that we are is that because men probably fear women, because we are super powerful. We're powerful beings.
Well, you know what? We see, from the man perspective, we see the woman directly connected to the natural cycles of this planet. She menstruates with the moon. The same cycle, the same period of days as the menstruation with the moon. The woman also births life onto the planet, suckles life onto the planet, nourishes that just like the planet does for all the plants and animals. We see that, and the women directly feels that as like the feminine energy of the woman, of the planet, right? And the moon and the relationship. Males, we can't see a direct connection of where we actually fit and belong. It's very difficult to see that. So I think that's why we have to go and, like, we're warriors and we go and conquer and destroy. It's like because we're mad trying to find that deep connection, and we're in 10,000 years of patriarchy of submitting and subverting the feminine power that before that was a goddess worshiping society. It was matriarchal as far as like the hierarchies of civilization, of people, of tribes.
Well,
and
you know,
I think it's scared because we're so scared. We have to repress you to vote. You can't drive. You can't do that. You know,
right.
And that is all because I think of fear, which has led us to 2019. And we have the situation at hand on this planet. So,
well, you know, I promised you before we came on that we would argue a little bit. And I will argue a little bit this idea of women as our highest sort of power, being the power to give birth, which I don't in theory disagree with, but I recently read this psychological article that was talking about women connected to nature and men connected to culture. And what's happened is, as a society, we understand women have the power to give birth, women have menstrual cycles, which are in line, as you said, with the rhythms of nature. But what happens then as a result of identifying women with nature and men with culture is that men are associated with things like nation building, society building, invention, the creation of, let's say, objects that are useful to a society in an ongoing way. And that posits this argument that then women's sort of highest or only functions are related to nature, and that we can't be creators and contributors to culture. And not to say that's what your point is, but that
let's
dichotomy,
be careful that we don't create another stereotype. That
well,
keeps,
no, it's
well,
dangerous.
It's not a stereotype. I think it's recognizing, because culture is man's invention, a human's invention. It's right what you're saying. But again, going down deeper pre all of that, I'm just saying kind of the essences of the masculine, feminine, that, you know.
Sure.
And it is. I mean, 10,000 years is history, his story written by man. And so for what you're talking about, nation building, the inventors and all that, it is because man has told the story that we all believe for so long. And so the problem is that we believe it, and now it's time for more women to get involved, to start shaping the story of who we are as a human being, yeah, that's been here for roughly 200,000 years evolving on this planet, you know? And it's like we are way, way, way out of touch with the feminine side of the self, right? You know, I mean, and I think that now is a major awakening of the feminine in the human experience from stuff like, you know, I know there's a lot of controversy around the Women's March and all that, but you know, the Me Too movement, all that, there's a surge of feminine happening. I also say that cannabis legalization is a very feminine thing. The effects of cannabis on the person is very different than the effects of alcohol on the person. Alcohol is much more aggressive and masculine. The cannabis is much more gentle and, you know, and I'm not supporting either one of them, but also all the psychedelic research of MDMA, psilocybin mushrooms, DMT, LSD, all of this, to me, I see what's happening right now is there's a feminization happening on this planet. And it's really interesting to be kind of like alive and experiencing that. But I agree with what you're saying. It's true. But I think that that's the result of exactly this, because man has been doing it all for so long. Yeah. And that is the narrative that we've been told. And that's the narrative that we now believe because of that, for sure.
So going back to Simone.
Yes, Simone.
So you told us when you were talking about your yoga teaching that you teach in public libraries and you teach in jails. So, of course, that is very interesting to everyone, I'm sure. And I know you've said before, you know, you have a body, you can move, you can breathe, that's all. But I'm sure jail has to be different just because of the pain and the stress that your students are going through, and I'm sure having that space to just have a little bit of peace, it's got to be extremely needed for them, much more than for us. So I wanted to hear a little bit about your experience teaching in jail.
Yeah. One thing I will say, though, is that I think that, you know, many spiritual leaders throughout history have talked about the different types of prisons, and many of the prisons that we're in are mental slavery. And I don't mean that as an exaggeration. I mean that quite literally, that many people feel trapped, and feeling trapped and feeling anxiety and feeling enclosed, whether it's in your office, whether it's in a marriage that's unhappy. So many of us who are outside of secure facilities, who are not incarcerated, are living in different types of prisons. And so in many ways, I think what's most surprising to people when I tell them, there are things about going to the jail like waiting 5 minutes for a door to open, or an incident that may occur, like you know, a small fight or a shutdown or a lockdown or something that is specific to an incarcerated facility. But on a day-to-day basis, most of the classes, if you walked in and let's say I blindfolded you and you just, you know, put your mat down, you might think this is not different than any other yoga class, because again, the way that I teach and the way that the students teach me is that as long as there's respect and the space feels safe, people are just breathing and moving. I have students who are very limited in their mobility. That's another thing that is particular to the jail that I think actually could exist in other classrooms if students felt welcome and they felt like it was a safe space for them. I was talking to students yesterday about studios that have stairs. It's possible that we could make accommodations that someone, you know, could enter if they didn't normally go upstairs. We could redirect them to a studio that didn't have stairs. We could, you know, figure out a ramp. There's things that could happen. But I think most people would self-select out and they would say, this is not a space for me. And so in the jail, you know, the students are already there. So that's one thing, that when you meet people where they are, it's already, I think, a big comfort. People relax. It's like, you know, you have your berth in your home because you're comfortable there, because you want to be in control of your experience. And control is something that definitely the students who are inside the facility have very little of. They don't control when they eat, when they sleep. There's so many things out of their control. So I try to make this space, you know, often say to them, if you lie down on your back or sit in a chair and close your eyes for the next 45 minutes and you do none of the things that I'm recommending, that's okay. And the very first class I ever taught at the jail, this guy said to me, I have bullets all the way up my spine and I'm very limited in how I can move, but this is the most peaceful I felt in 10 years.
Damn.
And it's just being in the space, you know? And so the other thing I think is really important is that for me, service is an equal exchange. So I feel like I have some knowledge that I've been very privileged to be able to gain that I love and am humbled to be able to share. But I also learned so much from being in there. This funny thing happened, I think you guys would appreciate. A couple weeks ago, I was explaining to them that namaste, the gesture where you hold your hands together and you either bow or look somebody in the eye and acknowledge them, that in Asia, we don't often or even always, we don't need to say namaste. We can just join our hands and look you in the eye, and that greeting is understood the same way that here in the streets of DC, if you nod to someone and they nod back to you, that's understood as an acknowledgement of that person's humanity and maybe even how they are like you, right? And so I was explaining that to them, that we don't always need to say that, and that when I make this gesture that I'm acknowledging you, so that they didn't mistake it to be something tied up in dogma or religion, because it isn't. And so a couple of the guys dabbed to me and I said, what's your intention? They said, that's the dab. I said, I know what the dab is, but what is your intention? And they said, well, it's the same as yours. And we had this like really dope moment where, you know, I think that one thing that I do that maybe is different from some teachers is that I don't hold things to be precious, because in my experience, the best spiritual leaders, Thich Nhat Hanh and the Dalai Lama, and people who, Dharma Mitra, who's still alive in New York, who's our teacher, and I, you know, really have great respect and admiration for him. These people are silly. They have childlike qualities. They don't preach anything.
They don't take themselves so seriously.
Yeah, they don't take themselves
that's
seriously.
That's one of the keys, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of
maybe because they don't have so much of a self.
Yeah, they're you know, their ego self is very.
And they understand the cycle of samsara, I think, which is just, you know, we're sure. Here in this just illusion, you know, of life. And ultimately, we're just in this very small planet, in this immense universe spinning around.
Yeah.
So what do we know?
Right.
Yeah.
So I think that's very helpful to teaching in that environment. But also I learn a lot about patience, because the things that happen before and after the classes, you know, there have been times where I've had to wait more than an hour for a class because of some other thing happening. There have been times when nurses or lawyers or visitors come, many distractions, many noises. It's not a traditional environment in that way.
Which jail do you go to?
There's just one, the DC jail. So DC is very interesting because it houses people who are there for a short stay. So they're either awaiting trial or their sentence is less than a certain amount of time, about a year. So it's a unique place. It's not like a federal facility where people are going to be there a long time. And I think that has a big impact also on my students' mentality. They are preparing themselves to leave, either to go somewhere else or to leave the facility. And so especially one of the groups that I work with is a unit that has been selected because they are getting ready to be released within a certain short period of time. And so their energy is very receptive to the teachings because they're ready to see how can they use, they'll take anything, any information that will help them as they reintegrate into society. And so it's the perfect time actually to be with them because they are very, very receptive and open to learning. Okay, how can I breathe better? How can I move better? Even when, you know, one of the first questions I'll ask them is what they know. You know, what do you know about the yoga practice, about meditation? And one of the frequent comments is, oh, that's that thing that white people do, right? They say, that's that thing white women do, right?
White women, that's awesome.
And I love that conversation. That first conversation is so funny and
with
fun.
With Lululemon pants.
Yes, yes, yeah. Yes.
The crackers, those are crackers.
Yeah, you know, that's that thing white women do. Like, and it's just, it's almost like no malice in their hearts either. Like, it's just a fact to them. Like, that's the thing that white women do. And I say, you know, why not us, right? And one of the questions that there's an organization called SAPIA. It's the South Asian Practitioners of Yoga in America. It's a long acronym. But SAPIA has done a lot of really interesting work. And one of the questions the founder asked in an interview, she's like me, she asked questions in her interviews. And she said, who gets to heal? And so that's a question I think that is really important for us to think about and that I'll pose to my students, right? Yeah, that's the thing that white women do, but why not you? You know, why not, why don't you have access to the most simple thing, like you said, that's already within inside, it's inside yourself. It's within yourself to breathe better, to just take a deep, long breath.
I think we can change the world with that. If people learn how to breathe.
That's also what Thich Nhat Hanh says.
Proper breathing. No, something that's so, so basic, fundamental, and simple, but yet how so many people get
healing.
It wrong. Just to be able to first properly breathe, you know, not to be up in the diaphragm, but to come from down deep in the bandhas, like down in the seat, and something just that basic, that fundamental, to really learn about the breath and
makes
then
you
to
connect
proper breathe.
With your body.
Yeah, that could change something so non-existent, simple, could make such like major changes in an individual, and then obviously out from the individual.
Definitely. Hey, I think we need to take a short break here. We are talking to Simone Jacobson. She is Swiss Army knife extraordinaire. I mean, she does it all, and I want to hear more about the food aspect in your life. I want to hear about hip hop, so many things. So I think we're going to be right back to hear more about Simone.
We'll be right back.
We're back at the Dolcezza Sherber Experience. We're here today with Simone Jacobson. Simone, one of the things she does, she's the co-owner of Tolly Molly, a Burmese bodega in Union Market. And we met you back when you were starting with Tolly Molly, and you came to our gelato factory with your lovely mom to show us your faluda, which is a Burmese dessert that you introduced to DC with your mama. So why don't you tell us more about the beginnings of Tolly Molly and that first encounter at the gelato factory?
I am so glad that you asked me about that because...
Shout out, Jocelyn.
Shout out to my mom, Jocelyn Layon, and to my business partner, Eric Wang, because without them, there would be no Tolly Molly. Often, I'm the person that has to go and jump into the fire of these conversations, but they are really the true heroes. My mom is from Burma. And faluda is a layered dessert drink that's very popular in Burma, but originated in Iran. The Iranians call it faludeh, and traveled all around the world. And we call this faluda nation because as we started our business, we started to realize that faluda was so popular, or some version of faluda. So Koreans have pat bingsu, Vietnamese have jia. There's a Taiwanese shaved ice version. So many different similar kind of icy or cold layered dessert drinks, a very Asian and Asian diaspora thing. So when we first started, it took me a really long time to convince my mom, who had been a teacher for more than 15 years. She taught in both Arizona and here in DC. And it took me a long time to convince her that we were capable of starting a business with no money and no real resources other than just willpower and a few connections and just really the desire.
Sounds familiar.
Right? And so it took me a long time to convince her. And when I finally did, I actually would say almost single-handedly, Rob may have been the tipping point of her believing me because, you know, I'm her oldest daughter. And so I think it's sort of like she assumes that I just say things to please her or to be kind to her. But when somebody else, right, who's not her family, then I think it gave her a lot of confidence. So what happened was we had done two pop-ups, I think, before we met you. And the first one was an incredible adventure. It was at Eats Place. And it was the weekend after an epic snowstorm here in D.C. I mean, like almost up to your knees snowfall. And I just remember Eric and I slipping and sliding, carrying this coffee. We were like trying to be so ethical. We're like, we're going to get local. We're carrying these heavy jugs of coffee when we could have done it so many other ways. And we said, nobody's going to come. Who's going to come out after an epic snowstorm to eat a cold dessert drink they've never heard of from people they don't know? And 350 people came. And it just happened to be actually a very warm day that next weekend. It was like 50 degrees. But people came out, most of whom we didn't know, which was really, really encouraging. And then we did Ramen World at Mess Hall. And that's how we met Al Goldberg, who's remained a mentor, a friend, such a special person. And I'm not really sure why. Maybe he sort of like in an oracle, magical way was like, you need to meet Rob. And I was like, okay, you know, like we love Dolcezza and, you know, we should be so lucky. And so he set up this meeting and my mom, we always tease her because she's older than almost anybody in the food industry I know. And I won't share her age, but she's my mom. So she's old enough. And she's very aware of, she's very smart about her physical ability, which is more than most of my 20-year-old employees. But she often packs a Rolly suitcase. And that's kind of like her trademark. You're like, okay, we see the Rolly coming. We know Chef is coming. And so she packed up all these little containers in her Rolly suitcase. And we went to the Dolcezza factory. And I often, it's actually not something I do on purpose, but I often don't help tell her what we're doing. I just tell her what to do. So I said, make enough of faluda for four people. Meet me at this address. That was all the information I gave her. So we went to the factory with my mom with her little Rolly suitcase and her little jellies and her little basil seeds. And we made faluda for Rob. And I think you had some too, maybe. And my mom and Rob, they were like two kids, like twin souls like meeting for the first time, they start talking about, you know, anarchy and philosophy and art. And it was like, like you just see this like buzz around them. And I was just kind of observing with like this very full heart. And so after that happened, you know, and Rob was so encouraging, not in really an entrepreneurial way so much as I think what made my mom so emotional and happy was that he ate with such gusto. And that's actually all my mom cares about. She's an Asian grandma. All the Asian grandma really wants, right? I'm trying to start a business, but all she really wants is people to enjoy her food. And so what happened was when we left, she said, who is that wonderful man? Right? Because I hadn't told her anything about Rob. And so when she learned, you know, that you have such a successful business and not just successful, but related to us, you know, and that we could actually use your product. I mean, she was over the moon, but also a little embarrassing. She's like, I don't know him, you know, and she didn't know anything. And that was actually really endearing too, because it allowed her, she just was so herself, you know, she just let it open. And it was amazing because she really, I didn't even recognize it. That's why I say Al was kind of like an oracle. I didn't recognize how much she needed that encouragement. And with that confidence, you know, that's how we got connected to Union Market. And ended up having what was supposed to be a 30-day pop-up there that's now almost in year three.
That's so awesome. You know, yeah, all that for, mother, because of you. Well, your mom reminds me and reminded me of of Violeta's mom. So much like a very similar spirit and openness and spirituality, whatever that means. But your mom reminds me so much of Isabel.
My voice sucks.
I have
your voice sucks.
Yeah,
totally. But fucking fraud. It's okay.
I have a recording to play.
So Tolly Molly,
the end of the show because of my voice.
Yeah, that's okay. So I'm gonna talk. So Tolly Molly evolved into a Burmese bodega. And your mom cooks amazing stuff there, catfish curry, coconut noodles, falooda, of course. But you also sell all kinds of interesting Asian products. Tell me some weird things that you sell there.
Wow, we sell so many cool, weird things. We sell a lot of Burmese products. So one of the most traditional, unique, funky, and awesome things that we sell is pickled tea leaves. My mom says, and usually she's the, you know, like she's my CNN, she's my news source. I believe that it is true. Burma is the only country in the world that eats tea. So, of course, many places in the world drink tea, but Burma is known for lepet thot, which is a tea leaf salad. It's pickled tea leaves, and you add some kinds of crunchy things that can be onions, garlic, peanuts, like soybeans, all different kinds of beans and crunchy things, sesame seeds, tomatoes, either cabbage or lettuce or both. And so it's a very interesting, dynamic, layered salad. In San Francisco at Burma Superstar, which is probably the most famous Burmese restaurant in America, they call it a rainbow salad because it has so many different colors. And so we sell Burmese products. We also sell things from what we call the spice diaspora. So we have Latinx kinds of hot sauces. We have West African things. We sell a Trini hot sauce, which is made in the region. We sell za'atar, which is a spice from the Middle East made by our friends locally. They're called ZNZ, another family-owned business. And we sell frozen eel in the freezer. We sell little yogurt drinks, little Asian yogurt drinks, all different things from... Most of the products that we have are Asian, but we also sell things from the spice diaspora because there isn't really, we're the kind of cornerless corner store. There isn't really anything, first of all, besides Hana Market, which is a Japanese market that's been around 4 decades, I think, over in the U Street area. There isn't another Asian grocery store within the city limits. And just outside of DC and Virginia and Maryland, there's really a paradise of options, but there aren't that many here. And so we try to balance those things. Because we're so small, we have to be really selective about what we put on the shelves. Sometimes when people ask for rarer things, things that we've either tried and that haven't sold, we have to keep experimenting to see what's going to bring people back. And so the other thing I'm very proud of is that we have a partnership with Duende District. And Duende District specializes in books by, for, and about people of color. And so our shop is part bookstore, part bodega, corner store, and part kitchen. So we sell prepared foods like those that you mentioned. And that's fun. That's really fun. We've always wanted to be a snack shop in Burma and in so many places in the world. It's really common that you would find all those things in the same place. And we're just lucky that we've been able to do that at Union Market, because I'm not sure that compared to the other things in the neighborhood, we might be the most, you know, kind of out there funky thing in that neighborhood in terms of just the toli moly of it all. You know, toli moly means a little of this and a little of that. And to pack so many different things into one place, you know, you can get vegan version of pork rinds, the snacklins, and, you know, you can also get Rubia's Ruby Scoops. You know, you can get so many diverse products, and also maybe a book about, you know, a children's book that actually has brown people in it. That's pretty revolutionary.
It's pretty cool. You should check it out if you're out in Union
Momo
Market.
Momo sauce, right? The Dorji Momo. Didn't they make a hot sauce and you guys actually sell that?
They used to. And we did used to carry it. Now,
no longer.
I think we have. No, they're not making that anymore. But I think that we have at least a dozen, if not 30 or more different hot sauce and spicy things.
Much fun.
So I want to talk about the arts. We talk about yoga. We talk about food. There's a whole other aspect to your life. You are a hip-hop spreader, like Rob said. You are the deputy director of this nonprofit Words, Beats, and Life, right? So tell me, what's the mission of that organization?
Yeah, Words, Beats, and Life is now in its 18th year and started at the University of Maryland, where I also went to school. And the organization focuses on transforming both individual lives and entire communities. That over the course of almost 20 years has looked like a lot of different things. Community classes, in school, after school, workshops, conferences, an academic journal that's produced twice a year about hip hop culture, specializing in hip hop culture, which for a very long time was the only one in the world, academic peer-reviewed publication. Cultural exchange has been a major focus of ours over the last few years. And I'm working now mostly on adult programs and on cultural programs like this partnership that we have with Paris, France. So Paris and Washington, D.C. are sister cities. And for the first time in 5 years, we brought the U.S. qualifiers of Juste Debout. And Juste Debout is a competition meaning standing only. So it's the hip-hop dances that are not breaking, because breaking happens on the ground. So house, hip-hop, popping, locking, sometimes freestyle. It depends from year to year. And the tour goes across 15 cities all around the world. And we were the first stop on the tour and the first time Juste Debout has come back to the United States in 5 years. I'm really proud of that. And so our 8 dancers, 2 in each category, people compete in teams of 2. And so we have 8 total that won here in D.C. And they're from Canada, they're from the Congo, they're from all over, but they competed here in D.C. And so those 8 dancers will go to France actually next month. And they'll compete against...
Do you get to go?
Yes, I will be there. Yeah, I'm the mama. I'm the shepherd. I'm going to take care of our 8 dancers. So those 8 dancers will compete against all the people who won in the other 14 cities. And we are very confident that they have strong chances of winning. They're really strong dancers. And so those are the kinds of projects we've also done. We did a show called Footsteps in the Dark at Dance Place that I stage managed, I organized, I ran the lights for. You know, when we work in small organizations, we are sort of, we have to be Jills and Jacks of all trades, what I sometimes call multi-potentialite, because you have to be able to do a lot of different functions when the budget doesn't allow to hire. And it's the same thing with being entrepreneurs. You know, we step in. I'm as happy doing dishes as I am, you know, running a lighting board. Those are just, I think it comes naturally to people who are really curious learners. Ultimately, that's why I do so many different things, not to be radical or unique, but because I'm a curious learner. And if there's something to be learned and to be done, I'm ready for it. And so, yeah, so those are some of the things that I do.
So one of the curious projects, not curious, but you said you're a curious learner. One of the amazing things you've done is Illuminatia. So tell us about this cultural festival that you organized for the Freer Sackler Smithsonian Museum.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that was definitely among the absolute top highlights of my career. I worked as the food curator and video producer and co-event manager. Illuminatia was the grand reopening of the Freer Sackler. So the Smithsonian's Freer and Sackler galleries are Asian art museums. Their tagline is "Where Asia Meets America," because they have both American and Asian collections there. And they had been closed for renovations, one of the galleries for 2 years, the other for a brief period. And when they reopened to the public, they did this massive festival. We had 50,000 people over the 2 days.
It was the largest festival that they've ever had, right?
It was the largest event that the Freer Sackler has ever had, yeah. And it was on the National Mall. It was the first Asian night market on the National Mall. Many firsts, and also so many people's efforts went into making Illuminatia happen. We had video projection mapping on the front of the building, which is, if you've never seen it, it's sort of like if you can imagine a projection on a building that also moves and takes the shape and the form of the building.
They did that at the Hirshhorn.
Yeah, it's really, really incredible to see. And so we also had a bunch of local vendors that just, they got crushed. They really got their asses handed to them, because I think nobody could have expected what an incredible turnout we had. I think we knew it was going to be a lot. Also, the wharf had opened around that time. So it was just like really, I mean, when you think festival, this was as festival as a festival could be, you know, music and screen printing and, you know, Korean calligraphy demonstrations in the middle of the street. It was really, for all in every way, and lasted 2 days. So Saturday night and Sunday all day. And we also produced some videos for NPR. So NPR showed the stories of these local makers. So people like Lapis, Z&Z, Short Eats, Dorji Momo. Those were some of the videos that we featured that people can watch on NPR about these family. I mean, so many family, Asian and Asian American family-owned businesses in D.C. that I think people are still learning are out here.
Hey, going back to Dorji Momo, do you know what's going on with those guys? As far as weren't they doing something in Capitol Hill above the bagel shop for a while? And
yeah, I mean,
thinking about opening up their own.
Yeah, I think like a lot of us, you know, some of us who are families and in business together, we make it, and some of us who are families and in business together, the strain is too much. And I think that for them, the strain was too much, and they are not operating.
Right.
Currently, I think they're doing some individual projects, like, you know, they're making food, you know, but I think that, I mean, the restaurant project is not happening, but I think it's really important that people know, you know, people that are listening know that just because we do it, right? I see the two of you do it, you know, my mom and I are doing it. So many families that we know are doing it. It is so far from easy. And I think that sometimes, and this is not a criticism of the media, but just a fact that sometimes the story, and, you know, I'm so happy to be here with the two of you, because we have talked about this before. Often the story of my own business was always a very sweet story, right? And, you know, as a sweets business, as a dessert business, you know, I understand it's this kind of metaphor, oh, this mother daughter, and isn't it sweet? And it is, you know, my mom and I are very close and I love her. And at the same time, we also are big personalities, and some days it's really hard, and some days we don't get along, and some days we disagree. And I think that people need to understand, I've noticed that that people are quick to criticize. I was just talking with a friend before I came here about public transportation. And she was saying, where I come from, you know, I know family members who couldn't take a job, even though they had the right education, even though it would have been a great job for them, because there wasn't a safe form of transportation. And the reason I'm making this parallel is that the same is true with people being willing to criticize restaurants and restaurant owners without understanding our business. I mean, David Chang came out a couple years back, and I really respected when he said, I should charge you $30 for this bowl of ramen, but you won't pay it, right? So people are, you know, are you treating your workers well, and are you giving them health insurance? Are you doing these things? Tell me how with the prices you're willing to pay, right? And so it's the same thing. I don't mean to go off a different path, but I think that's an important example where people deserve some privacy and understanding when there are complicated reasons that restaurants don't work.
People 100%. Have no idea from the
no
I
mean, idea.
And when I say that, I can understand why. I mean, it's just like, the thing is this, when you're outside of something and not on the inside, the reality of what you think it is 100% different from the reality of what it actually is on the inside. So that gap of understanding is easy to see why. It's just the conclusions that one takes from the lack of understanding is the one that's like, you know, if you do not understand something fully from actually doing it yourself, it almost invalidates you to be a critic of it because you don't really understand what goes involved. And so it's like talking with all of our friends, restaurant owners that have been doing this for 10, 15 or 2 years or whatever, the perception of the business from the outside is always like, damn, they must be banking and rolling and the lines and all that. But to a small business owner, especially in the food business, where you actually try to do it with quality ingredients, is so hardcore. You put everything into it and all your partners, vendors and farmers and chefs into it. And it's really, really, really tough to do something with good quality, you know?
And make money.
And make money from it. So the perception of making money and banking from having a small family business is so far from the truth. It doesn't exist.
And make the partnership work, which is another thing that you were saying.
With the units involved, whether they be family or not. I mean, it is like so, it pushes you in every direction that you probably would not be pushed on your own choice or your own choosing. So it's so true.
And about being a Jill of all trades.
Yeah, we talk.
Holy moly. So, yeah.
This is something we talk about all the time because this is our reality. And so it's like, we love it, right? We've been doing this for 15 years and it's us. It's our way of making a lifestyle with our family. We just went to Uruguay for 5 weeks. Only reason that we can do this is because we own the business that gives us the vacation to do that kind of thing, you know? So it's really important. It is everything, but it ain't easy at all.
It ain't easy.
And it surely ain't banking. I wish.
So, Simon, we're about to get to an end here, but I want to know what's next for you. Since you are like this, like a brilliant, beautiful person.
Blossoming.
Yeah.
Burgeoning.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, I think that one of the things that is going to be really important to me going into this year is to, I've been very focused on work-life integration, and that's, you know, what you all are talking about. For me, work-life balance is really harmful to the individual because it's like wellness we talked about earlier. Sets up this paradigm like work over here, life over here. And, you know, I'm still not there yet. You know, work still does sometimes feel like I'm not catching up on life. So reading more books and doing my own practice more and doing things that are just the pleasure of sharing my own company with myself. But also in concrete things that are coming up, I'm really excited about working with the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn. And we have two more events in a 4-part series there called Chow X. So Chow X is focused on their exhibit Chow, the making of the Chinese American restaurant. And each month is a different theme. So December was Chow X Judaism, about the tradition of Jewish people eating Chinese food on Christmas. January was Chow X Mundo Latinx. So we talked about Chino Latino restaurants and we had a salsa dancing lesson. We had a chifa demo. So Peruvian Chinese, super great fun. And then in February, we'll be focused on the West Indies. So Chow X West Indies, China and the West Indies and the food and cultural connections and tensions there. And then in March, we're closing out with Women in Food. So the information is at MOFAD, MOFAD.org, so the Museum of Food and Drink. And I hope that if anybody's listening and you live in New York, you'll come out and join us.
That's awesome.
That's awesome. That's really cool.
Yeah, it sounds like a great project, as so many other things you do. So thank you so much for being here with us, Simone.
Simone, thank you so much.
It was such a beautiful conversation. So next time,
bring your mom on.
Yes, thank you so much. That's going to be, you're going to need at least an hour for that.
Thank you all. Be kind to one another. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts, covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook at Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening.